Wall Street's been up, it's been down. It's been up, it's been down. But today, it's all down. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood in for Kai Rizdahl. Welcome to September. It's the first day of the month, and so far, September is looking a little like the last week of August. The Dow is down 470 points today. We're now in the second week of extreme volatility in the markets. This morning, the New York Stock Exchange invoked something called Rule 48. It's used to hopefully stabilize trading when the exchange is set to open way up or way down. And the exchange has been using it a lot these days. Marketplace's Mark Garrison tells us why.
When word gets out it's a Rule 48 morning, traders tell clients to buckle up. NYSE floor veteran Ted Weisberg is founder of Seaport Securities.
It's usually a worst-case scenario, and it's our job to transmit that news to our clients.
Think of Rule 48 as letting the NYSE floor staff get straight to opening the market. It's unique to NYSE because real people manage the exchange's opening. The folks in blue jackets you see on TV in front of computer screens are called designated market makers, or DMMs. On a volatile day, determining the opening price can take more time. Charles Jones is a finance professor at Columbia Business School.
Those humans actually have limited processing capacity, so it's really designed to make things a little easier on the humans.
Stocks don't open at the same price where they closed the day before because stuff happens overnight that affects companies. If crazy stuff happens to a company, the DMM may have to give out additional information, which can delay the stock's opening. And if the whole market is volatile, that could mean a widespread NYSE opening delay. Amber Anand is a Syracuse finance professor.
It could add to the uncertainty in the market. So in that scenario, it might be better to just let trading start, see where markets end up.
And that's what Rule 48 does. In that way, the rule is different than other market safeguards like circuit breakers and limit up, limit down, which pause trading. But in a situation like today, a delayed opening could add to anxiety, says Sayana Mustofi with the TAB Group.
The thought behind it is that once they open, it will do away with the uncertainty in the market in terms of seeing the prices change.
Even if it's a rocky day on the floor, Wall Street still wants to know the numbers. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
The European Union is finding that it wants to be the kind of place that has open borders, at least in concept. But many of the countries that make up the union are having trouble with the reality. That's because hundreds of thousands of migrants and refugees who have been flooding into Europe are straining the bonds of the economic union. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has more.
The European Union was a grand economic experiment that was supposed to unify the continent. A big part of that was the open border policy, which is now being challenged.
It has prompted Europeans to do a lot of soul searching.
Kostas Kordakakis is a professor at the University of Illinois. He says Europeans have been able to move around Europe to live and to work.
With very few restrictions for the last 20 or 30 years. So I think this principle is so much deeply enshrined, if you like, in European Union consciousness.
He worries the migrant and refugee crisis is making many countries want to limit that movement. Jacob Kierkegaard is with the Peterson Institute. He says Germany is warning it might reinstate border control if the EU doesn't act as a whole to deal with the problem.
Because you have these supranational open borders inside the euro area that allows people to physically move around freely. But then you have, for instance, national rules for asylum.
Heather Conley is director of the Europe program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. She says people who land in Greece might prefer Germany, which has more generous asylum policies.
Because the external borders have not been able to be secured, what's happening is the problem is being passed along country by country.
Countries struggling to find a unified response to a growing problem. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, Rule 48 or no Rule 48, it's a bloodbath. We'll have more when we do the numbers. It's also been a bloodbath in the digital camera market for the last decade or so. Polaroid didn't fare as badly as, say, Kodak, but let's just say it's been touch and go. Now Polaroid is trying to stay in the camera game with action cameras and instant printers. It's got its name on televisions and even a line of low-cost Android phones. And it's been raising its profile at big consumer electronics events, like the one happening this week in Berlin. Polaroid CEO Scott Hardy is here. Thanks for joining me.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me on your show.
So there has been a fair amount of talk about Polaroid lately. It seems like you're staging a little bit of a comeback. Is that safe to say?
Yeah, we feel like that Polaroid as a brand is going through a tremendous resurgence right now. You know, we have a wide array of products that we've been launching that are very relevant to the consumer. But even on the analog instant film side, which most people associate the Polaroid brand with, we actually have a tremendous amount of interest and demand for those products, which we've been actively selling.
Is there a company or product that you look at and think, as we effect a turnaround, as we rebuild our brand, that's the roadmap? That's how we want to do it?
Well, you know, of course, everybody looks at Apple, right? And Apple mm-hmm. is really now the only tier one, you know, consumer electronics brand. And, you know, what's interesting with Apple is Steve Jobs idolized Edwin Land, the founder of Polaroid. Edwin Land would turn his board meetings into these product launch events, these unveilings. And what Steve Jobs loved about Edwin Land was that Polaroid was always about the intersection between art and technology. And so we're always saying, how can we take design and infuse that into our products better? And I think that's where we've been putting a lot of emphasis recently.
And who do you see as your competition?
You know, there's so many different consumer electronics players out there, and it all depends on whatever category you're in. But the other thing, too, is we're really a global company, and so every market around the world has different competitors. You know, we sell in 100 markets around the world right now, and depending on the region, depending on the territory, you know, you can have local competitors who may be brands that people don't even recognize. So I would say it's really dictated based on category and region.
Now, you've been in the tech world for a long time. Some people might have said that a camera company would be an old model. What attracted you to Polaroid?
You know, in the case of Polaroid, to me, it was all about being able to get involved in something that had an iconic brand. You know, Polaroid is a brand that has 100% awareness around the world. It's one of the few trademarks in the world that is classified by the different international trademark offices as being a famous mark. And so Polaroid had this kind of cachet and retro cool factor to it that really attracted me to get involved with the business. And I also saw an opportunity to make Polaroid more than just what it historically had been. The brand has such power and you know, interest and relevance with the consumer that we really just had to change our business strategy. And by doing that, I think we've been able to effectuate a pretty successful turnaround.
Scott Hardy is the Chief Executive Officer of Polaroid. Scott, thanks for being on.
Thank you. My pleasure.
College classes are starting back up. You can tell by the sales on dorm furniture at Target. And at some of the country's most selective campuses, more low-income students than ever are joining the freshman class. Elite colleges have been under pressure to do a better job recruiting these high-achieving kids. And some have. Vassar College in Poughkeepsie is one. It has the reputation of being among the most diverse selective colleges, despite starting 150 years ago as a school for rich white Protestant girls. But now that more low-income students are at the school, Vassar's trying to do a better job of making them feel at home. From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR, Amy Scott reports.
Gabriel Ramos remembers the first time he felt out of place at Vassar College. He was in his dorm talking to a fellow student about high school.
He was like, yeah, so I had to do a project on the Holocaust. So my mom was like, let's go to a Holocaust museum. So we flew to Europe and then, you know, we toured a couple Holocaust museums and I really was ready to do my project.
Gabe did not grow up in the kind of family that could just jet off to Europe to do field research for a high school project. His mom worked as a bus driver. His dad moved from job to job. Neither parent went to college.
I was like, okay, you are very different from me.
But there are a lot more students with backgrounds like Gabe's than there used to be at Vassar. Over the past 8 years, the financial aid budget has doubled. 60% of students now receive aid. But that means 40% come from families that can afford to pay full price, more than $63,000 a year. And at the beginning, the divide was stark.
What our students were telling us is that they felt that they didn't belong.
Benjamin Lotto is the dean of studies at Vassar.
They were great students. They graduated, they did good work, they got good grades, but they weren't happy here. They felt like the school was for someone else.
Those students pushed the college to make changes, and the transitions program was born.
If we could just start this off the way that we should, please just clap it up for yourselves. Welcome to the class.
Now in its sixth year, Transitions is a pre-orientation program for low-income, first-generation, and veteran students. They arrive on campus several days before the rest of the freshman class, almost 2 weeks before classes start. At the welcome dinner for students and their families, they're told over and over that they belong here.
This is your Vassar. This institution is not a gift to you. You are a gift to us.
Students learn about all the different support services on campus. There are workshops on financial aid and career development and tutoring. And there are lots and lots of opportunities for students to bond with each other. They tour the city of Poughkeepsie and go bowling together. Louis Inoa, who runs the program, was the first in his Dominican family to go to a four-year college.
I liken it to a little bit of like, Miracle-Gro. Transitions is just important to kind of give them a head start with some of those, the necessary relationships.
The program, along with Vassar's recruiting efforts, has won the college accolades. Last spring, it received a $1 million award from the Jack Kent Cook Foundation for its success in attracting and graduating low-income students. Vassar President Catherine Bond Hill says low-income students are graduating at the same rate as students overall.
Which is, I think, a very important measure of success because the advantages of going on to higher education come from actually getting the degree.
But for this new crop of transition students, it's a long way to graduation. In a session called Counseling and Self-Care, they're encouraged to take advantage of the college's mental health services.
So the first thing we want you to remember the counseling service is we are free, right? So free.
Money is out in the open in these sessions. Part of helping low-income students fit in is recognizing that they can't afford a lot of extras. Junior Gabriel Ramos, the student who told the Holocaust Museum story, says that can make for some awkward situations, like when some of his friends were planning a trip to Mexico for spring break.
I'm like, y'all can go. It's fine. Go to Mexico. But I'm not going to go. And there's been other times where people are like, let's go out to dinner. I'm like, I got to pay my phone bill. So yeah, those moments do happen.
Then there are deeper insecurities. Incoming freshman Catherine Hernandez was a top student at her vocational high school in Las Vegas. Even so,
my biggest fear is not like meeting up to the rest of like the intellectual expectations like everybody around me. So sometimes I'm afraid just that because I don't have the natural aptitude to do things that I'm not going to measure up.
That's a pretty common feeling among first-generation college students. It's known as imposter syndrome. To build confidence, students get a dry run in the classroom.
Here is a reading guide to help you make your way through the chapters.
They spend a few days taking mini classes taught by professors who were first-generation college students themselves. Along with the reading assignments and homework, sociology professor Erindira Rueda takes her students through an exercise called Common Ground. They stand in a circle, and students step to the center if they share something in common.
Common ground if you grew up translating for your family. What sorts of things did you translate?
Forms, exoterms.
Freshman D'Angelo Mori was one of the students to step forward. He grew up in South Carolina. He was one of just a handful of Hispanic kids in his mostly white high school.
I'm pretty excited. I thought, there was only a few of us, but I'm very surprised to see that there are other people like me, because all my life I felt very alone.
He wasn't the only student who was surprised to realize he had to make his way to an elite campus in the Hudson Valley to feel like he finally fit in. In Poughkeepsie, New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
A U.S. district judge in San Francisco ruled today that a lawsuit brought by Uber drivers against that company about whether they are actually employees of Uber can go forward as a class action suit. There are some exceptions on which drivers can actually be part of the lawsuit, but most of them, it seems, will be able to be part of it. If it's successful, the lawsuit would cover about 150,000 Uber drivers. Those drivers have argued that they should be classified as employees and not independent contractors. And if they're found to be employees, it'll cost Uber a lot more. There's a similar lawsuit happening against Lyft, and this ruling could affect that one too. Coming up,
soda has held that throne for several decades, but it will no longer in about 2 years.
Two words for you: bottled water. But first, let's do the numbers. Numbers are down, as you might have guessed. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 469 points, 2.8% to close at 16,058. The NASDAQ shed 140 points, 2.9% to finish at 4,636. And the S&P lost 58 points, just shy of 3% to end at 1913. The auto industry felt the love last month, at least in terms of sales. August sales were the best since July 2005, thanks to mostly pickup trucks and SUVs. That's cheap oil talking. But stocks sagged following the mood of the market. General Motors reversed 2.7%, Ford dipped 1%, Toyota slipped 2.2%, and Fiat Chrysler was off 3%. Bonds rose, the yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.15%, and you're listening to Marketplace. You're listening to Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. You know how when you go buy a concert ticket or a sports game ticket online, first you see the price, and then there are all those fees during the checkout? It's annoying, right? Well, the online ticket reseller StubHub wanted to change that by adding the fees into the price up front, so you knew what you'd be spending. It was like truth in advertising. But I'm saying wanted, past tense, because StubHub's experiment is now over. It turns out people just thought StubHub was more expensive, and they took their business somewhere else. As Marketplace's Nova Sappho reports, when it comes to comparison shopping, we don't always know what's good for us.
When StubHub switched to all-in-one pricing, few competitors followed, and that was the problem, says Curtis Chang, who runs a service called DreamTix. It groups together tickets for live events and sells them on multiple sites.
When consumers search on Google, when they see that StubHub is $100 with the fees and everybody else is around 90 or 80.
Yeah, that didn't work out too well. Some ticket brokers reported that their StubHub business dropped by as much as half. In August, the company went back to offering some tickets without fees in the quoted price. Chang saw the results right away.
Their market share has gone up, on our data, about 5.2%.
John Gerville could have predicted this. He teaches marketing at Harvard Business School.
Yeah, and we like life simple.
Gerville says we don't want to think too hard about prices, so we take shortcuts.
A simple shortcut is just to do what you think of as an apples-to-apples comparison and choose the least expensive one.
Companies know this, Gerville says, and try to trick us by competing on price but not necessarily selling the same thing or the same amount. E-commerce analyst Sacharita Mulparu of Forrester Research says that's made us all kind of jaded.
There's a psychology of not trusting anyone anyway.
So even when a company like StubHub says, hey, this is the total price, really, we don't believe them.
Consumers don't really know what is truly an all-inclusive price. There's never that level of transparency anywhere, really, in American retail.
And now with StubHub's experiment over, Mulparu says it may be a while before someone tries something like that again. I'm Nava Safa for Marketplace.
Here's another little bit of weird psychology for you. Despite having some of the best and safest tap water in the entire world, most of us, go on, admit it, are buying bottled water in droves. Our love of drinking water out of little plastic bottles is creating an environmental disaster, not to mention how much water it takes to bottle a bottle of water, and how we're spending money to buy water that we could be drinking for free. And yet, a story this week in the Washington Post says bottled water is about to become America's most consumed packaged drink. Roberto Ferdman wrote that story. Hi, Roberto. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm great. So let's talk about the marketing here. I feel like I actually remember a time when bottled water was rising, was becoming a bigger presence in our lives, and people said, I'm never going to buy that. Water comes out of the tap. How much of this is a marketing coup?
You're right. If you go back to about the 1970s or so, bottled water was unheard of. What's happened is, as you pointed out, there's been a marked campaign to get people to want to drink it. Part of that has come from a growing villainization of tap water in the United States. There's been fear-mongering around fluoride levels, about the quality of tap water, when in fact we live in a country where the municipal water system is about as good as anywhere in the world. But then there's also been a selling of these different bottled waters. You have them selling a lifestyle that's associated with them, selling them as a healthy product, an alternative to soda drinks, when in fact the alternative is drinking water from the tap. And it's proven really effective, so effective that the average person consumes something like 35 gallons of bottled water a year, which is about 270 bottles. That's a lot of bottled water. And it's going up. By 2017, the understanding is that all of these different forces that have pushed us to drink more bottled water will make it the most popular packaged beverage in the United States. Soda has held that throne for several decades, but it will no longer in about 2 years.
Is there any sense that people refill those plastic water bottles, or is it a purely wasteful experience?
I don't think that there is comprehensive data or data that we should trust. But I do know this. I know that the companies who sell the water bottles, like Coca-Cola and Pepsi and Nestle, claim that they are recyclable. And that is true. Most of the water bottles for the United States are recyclable, but two-thirds of water bottles that are used in the United States end up going into landfill. And we know that plastic is not biodegradable.
And is that the primary impact, the environmental impact, or are there other sort of secondary effects like wasting water or taking it from sensitive places?
That's a serious one, the plastic that we use in order to drink from these plastic water bottles. But also, it takes about 3 or 4 liters of water in order to produce a liter of bottled water, which is to say that we use a lot more water when we're bottling it. And that is problematic as well, especially right now in places like California where we don't have a lot of water, in fact, places where we're rationing it. So there's a kind of a two-pronged problem with this. On the one hand, we're using plastic that we don't need to use, and on the other hand, we're using water that we don't need to use.
And so is there an alternative? Is there some sort of plan for a campaign for tap water?
Ideally, what we would do is we would convince people to either buy bottles that they can refill or that we make it as readily available as possible. Part of the problem is that if you're in a place like New York, you're probably closer to somewhere that you can buy a bottle of water than somewhere that you can have water from the tap, like a water fountain. So there's a little bit of urban development around getting people to drink tap water, but we really haven't found an effective solution, and that's kind of laid very clear in the sales trends, which are all upward.
Roberto Ferdman is a reporter at The Washington Post. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It's fair to note that there are some places trying to force us to change our habits. At least 18 national parks in the U.S. have banned the sale of bottled water, selling cheap, refillable water bottles instead, and offering refill stations around the parks. Some airports, music festivals, and college campuses are doing the same. And this final note before we go, who hasn't walked into McDonald's at 10:35 a.m. and asked for an Egg McMuffin, only to be told breakfast ends at 10:30? Well, those days are over, starting next month. After years of resisting the will of its customers, McDonald's announced today that it will start selling breakfast all day, starting on October 6th. Like I said, people have been asking for this for years, but McDonald's always said it just wouldn't work. Something about its grills not being big enough for both burgers and breakfast. But now the company is facing its worst sales in over a decade, and it's looking for a boost. According to Bloomberg, internal documents say McDonald's could increase sales as much as 2.5% per year just by selling McMuffins all day. You know, maybe if the Golden Arches had just listened to folks sooner, it wouldn't be in this predicament at all. That's it. That is Marketplace. Thank you for listening. Today, the Dow dropped 469 points, 2.8%. The NASDAQ shed 140 points, 2.9%. And the S&P 500 lost 58 points. That is just shy of 3%. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital producer is Tony Wagner. And the senior digital producer is Nishat Kurwa. I'm Molly Wood. Kai is back tomorrow. Have a great evening. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.